Good afternoon. This is the Diversity and Litigation Panel. I'm Michael Francisco on the Federal Society Litigation Executive Committee, and it's my honor and personal privilege to introduce Judge Patrick Dumonte, who will be presiding over this panel. As I'm sure people know in this room, Patrick has excellent credentials. He went to Harvard and Yale, served as a prosecutor in San Diego, clerked for, in my humble opinion, the best judge on the 10th Circuit, yeah. Judge Timothy Timkovich, yeah. And has quickly proven himself to be an excellent jurist on the 9th Circuit. If there was any thought from the liberals that they were getting a conservative diversity pick when Patrick was nominated, I think they've clearly found out now that he's a rock-ribbed conservative who's really made a name for himself with his courageous judicial opinions. And importantly, Patrick is almost as good of a skier as he is a jurist. And with that, I'll hand it over.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. Thank you, thank you. So good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be moderating this important panel. It's called Diversity and Modern Litigation. This panel will grapple with the legality and wisdom of identity-based preferences in the legal profession, education, and the corporate world. When discussing any issue of law and race, I can't help but think of Justice John Marshall Harlan's famous dissent in Plessy versus Ferguson. Harlan wrote, "Our Constitution is colorblind and neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens. In respect of civil rights, all citizens are equal before the law. The humblest is the peer of the most powerful. The law regards man as man and takes no account of his surroundings or his color when his civil rights, as guaranteed by the supreme law of the land, is guaranteed." This interesting panel will discuss how this principle may play out in modern litigation. So now I'll introduce our panelists, starting with Roger Saravino. Roger now serves as the Vice President of Domestic Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Roger has also been the director of HHS's Office of Civil Rights, and he was a trial attorney at DOJ's Civil Rights Division. Next, we'll have Dean Andre Douglas Pond Cummings. He's the new dean of the Widener University Law School. He just started in June, is that correct?
I did.
Yeah, so congratulations, Dean.
I'm still alive.
And Dean was also the co-founder of the University of Arkansas's Center for Racial Justice and Criminal Justice Reform. Then we'll have my good friend Toby Young. Toby is the senior vice president of legal at Cognizant and is a member of the board of directors at Halliburton. At Cognizant, Toby manages government relations and regulatory affairs. As a proud member of the Chickasaw Nation, Toby was the first tribal member to clerk on the Supreme Court. Toby has also served in DOJ's Civil Rights Division. Lastly, we'll have Professor Daryl Jackson of the University of Wyoming College of Law, where he's the director of its Prosecution Assistance Program. He previously served as a director of diversity services at George Mason Law School. He's written extensively on critical race theory. He's previously been an AUSA and an assistant county attorney. So before we get to the questions section, each panelist will start with their opening statement. Roger, do you want to kick us off?
Certainly. I'll start with a story, personal story. When I applied to grad school, I was amazed by the fact that the head of the admissions came out to LA to visit. And I was at this nice restaurant and wined and dined, and I got to the school, Carnegie Mellon, and they offered me far more than the next competitor school, and it was wonderful, and I accepted. Great school, things were going great, and I got to know the admissions director better. And then one day, I was in his office, and he pulled out and opened his drawer and showed me a list. And it was a list of every minority student that he got to come to Carnegie Mellon. I was on that list. And he said, "You know all that extra stuff I did for you, right? It's because I put you on this list." And he thought that I would react with some sort of, I don't know, I'm not sure what he thought how I would react, but I'll tell you how I did react. My heart dropped. I thought, wow, you weren't doing that because you thought I was special. You weren't doing that because I was Hispanic. And I felt belittled and I was ashamed that my name was on that list. So I felt like, wow, now I really got to kick butt, right, and prove myself here. And thankfully I did. I did exceedingly well. And when it came time to apply to law school and I applied to Harvard, I did not check the box because I had been a beneficiary of affirmative action racial preferences. I could not in good conscience say I can be reduced to a box and put on a special list and given special treatment. There was an African-American woman in grad school who was on that list. And I mentored her because she was failing in econometrics. She should not have been in that class. Why was she put in that class? Because she was on that list. I did everything I could to make sure she did not fail. But she was put into that position, set up for failure, because of the color of her skin. So let's look forward with the legal profession. Imagine if I, as a young lawyer, and I did at least summer associates at Big Law, but presumed I continued that path, I, as a young lawyer, were put on a big case. And I'm feeling great about myself. Wow, I've made it. And then maybe a year later, the lead litigator calls me into his office, opens a drawer, and shows me a list. And says, you know, we have this diversity initiative, and that client, they really pay our bills. That, you know, nice bonus you got, it's because of this client. But the reason we put you on this case is because they had certain demands of us as to the composition of the legal team litigating. So not necessarily was it, this is how I would interpret it, the best lawyers called to do the job, but of a certain color, a certain background, a certain sex. I would feel the exact same way as when I felt in grad school. My heart would sink, and I'd feel I'd have to prove myself. I would feel that, wow, all those clients in the room knew that I was the token, and all eyes would have been on me to see, all right, is that guy measuring up? Because we know why he's here. So that's the way it works in the real world. That's the way it impacts minorities. And there's, of course, another side. And we're going to be debating that other side. But I wanted to open up by at least putting that sort of human side of things, and with the legal profession in particular. So we have the Harvard case, which was a clarion call to say racial preferences do not belong in civil society, that we're past that, and that includes giving preferences to previously horrifically discriminated against minority communities. The legal profession has a very big problem on their hands because they were the drivers of DEI infrastructure. And I had a big Twitter debate with Mark Cuban on this point. I said, it was the lawyers, it was the HR departments, and he was saying, no, there's a great return on investment. We had like 12 tweets we exchanged. It was pretty cool. So, yeah. And then I said, no, it was really the lawyers. So I said, there's some good evidence for that. So I'll read some names of law firms on the Harvard case. In favor of the Asian American students, it was ACLJ, America First Legal, Counsel for McCarthy, of course, Mountain States Legal, Judge Stone, Cooper and Kirk. On the other side, Covington, Latham, Arnold and Porter, NAACP, Proskauer Rose, Linklaters, Pillsbury, Jenner Block, Steptoe, Ropes and Gray, Greenberg, O'Melveny, Goodwin, Aiken Gump, Munger, Quinn Emanuel. On the other side. They lost. Every single one of those big law firms lost. And now they have to reckon with that position. Now, do I have very high confidence that they're going to accept the decision of the court with open arms? I'm not at all confident. But I will leave you with this. I hope they read the ending of the opinion. Many universities, and they should add law firms, have for too long wrongly concluded that the touchstone on an individual's identity is not challenges bested, skills built, or lessons learned, but the color of their skin. This nation's constitutional history does not tolerate that choice. Thank you.
Dean, if you'd like to go next.
Good afternoon. I am Andre Cummings, Dean at Widener Law Commonwealth. I'm delighted to be here today, and I want to thank Christine Bryant, the Federalist Society, Judge Bumate, my fellow panelists for inviting me to be here with you at the Federalist Society National Convention. This is a first for me. I'm not speaking with the Federalist Society, but being at the National Convention, so I'm delighted to be here. Why affirmative action? That's where I always like to start and ground our conversation. Affirmative action, as you all know, began with Bakke in the 1980s, and it was because the University of California Davis Medical School recognized that for 100 years they had disallowed black students to enter into their medical school. It was not just you're not qualified, it was you may not enter. And so when we as a nation and UC Davis and the Supreme Court started trying to grapple with affirmative action, it was because there had been, as Roger mentioned, a horrifying discrimination against black and brown people and women for over a century. So I always like to ground the conversation, and the reason that affirmative action even began was to try to remedy an evil of discrimination and not allowing black and brown citizens, as well as women, the opportunity, the same equal opportunity that was afforded to primarily white males. So that's what we're trying to remedy: slavery, Jim Crow, historical oppression, the fact that folks were not allowed to compete on an equal playing field. So affirmative action ultimately was about trying to level the playing field. Was it a pristine effort? Was it well applied? No. Affirmative action has struggled since the beginning. In my view, affirmative action should have been much more vastly used if the effort was to provide equal opportunity to everybody. But we're here today talking about SFFA and the fact that affirmative action for 45 years struggled to successfully provide open doors and opportunities to folks that had been historically shut out. Now, a lot of folks since SFFA came out have been dancing on the grave of affirmative action. It's the death knell, and Roger himself suggests that law firms may not apply with the law or law schools, and I'm here to suggest a couple of things about how law schools are dealing with SFFA and how I read the opinion. So first of all, I don't feel like SFFA was the death knell for affirmative action, certainly not the diversity rationale that I'll talk about briefly, for two reasons. First, the Roberts Court, as currently constituted, is a court that does not mind overturning precedent. It's done it over and over again and is bold in doing so. What I would suggest here is that the Supreme Court did not overturn Grutter, or by extension, Bakke. There was no explicit overturning. Some of the concurrences suggested, but there was no explicit overturning by Chief Justice Roberts of the diversity rationale or Grutter or Bakke. Secondly, the narrow finding of the case was that UNC and Harvard both failed to follow Grutter and Bakke. So the question is there a way to constitutionally follow Grutter and Bakke as those cases were not explicitly overturned? So for these reasons, I think it's fair to say that affirmative action is not dead, or at least the diversity rationale is not dead, and I'll talk about why I think that's true, because it remains good law, and in my view, creative, dedicated admissions teams can seat incredibly diverse classes of students at universities and law schools throughout the nation without running afoul of the Constitution or the law. Here's how. First, as Roger suggested, SFFA does forbid the practice of checking a box. In fact, as soon as SFFA came out, I required my admissions team to remove those boxes from our admissions application. You can no longer say, because I'm Hispanic, because I'm a black American, I am therefore diverse. Let me enter the law school. You can't do that any longer. What SFFA did was it drove us law schools, admissions boards, to individual holistic review of people's applications, which is what I would have hoped would have happened at Carnegie Mellon for Roger, is that they would have realized, other than him being Hispanic, that he was a super talented person that deserved entry based on that, rather than the fact that he checked a box that said Hispanic. So, under the diversity rationale, as I read it, Chief Justice Roberts provided a roadmap for how to constitutionally apply the diversity rationale, because he explicitly stated either right before or right after the portion that Roger read, nothing in this opinion, quoting Justice Roberts, should be construed as prohibiting universities from considering an applicant's discussion of how race affected his or her life, be it through discrimination, inspiration, or otherwise. Chief Justice Roberts continues, a benefit to a student who overcame racial discrimination, for example, must be tied to that student's courage and determination, or a benefit to a student whose heritage or culture motivated him or her to assume a leadership role or attain a particular goal must be tied to that student's unique ability to contribute to the university. In other words, the student must be treated based on his or her experiences as an individual, not on the basis of race, close quote. So what does that mean? I think my law school got it right. In 2024, we entered the largest class of diverse students in our history. 37% of our class identify as from being from diverse populations. 33% identify as first gen. 18% identify as LGBTQ. How did we do that? We read every application. We read every personal statement. We looked for diversity in our class because I agree, and I hope everyone in this room does, that diversity brings real value to the classroom and real value to the workplace.
Please don't interrupt.
So you may or may not agree with that comment, but the diversity that I'm talking about is not just racial diversity. It's not just gender diversity. It's diversity writ large. Religious, it includes worldview, it includes a very diverse place where ideas are exchanged, where folks do not share the same worldview. So I'd like to provide two recent examples of files that I have just read that illustrate Justice Roberts' conclusion. Okay? I want you to pretend you're a law school admissions dean or a dean of a law school and tell me whether these sound like students you'd like to enter your law school class. The first I just read is a Liberian refugee fleeing war-torn Liberia. His personal statement literally said his parents handed him across a border to a relative that got him to Baltimore in the United States. He was raised by a single grandmother, described extremely difficult adjustment to the U.S. as a young kid. He badly missed his parents and siblings. He viewed very difficult and violent environment in Baltimore, including witnessing gun violence. He had a very difficult time completing college. He had an enormous challenge succeeding on the LSAT because he had no resources to help him study for it. But he worked hard, he prepared for the LSAT, he's interested in working in state government, and he applied to our law school. Would you admit this student? Is this someone that you would want in your student body? I would, and we did. Secondly, a woman from Alaska. She's Native Alaskan from the Inuit tribe from the northern tip of Alaska. Whale hunters are her family who survived on the fishing of whales, and rarely were they able to go to take an airplane to a neighboring village to shop for groceries. She used what she called a honey bucket as a bathroom. Her grandfather was the village chief who rose in prominence to negotiate land and fishing contracts. And eventually, the federal government, he negotiated land contracts on behalf of his tribe in Washington, D.C. Her goal is to attend law school, return to her native community, teach financial literacy, and protect the treaties and agreements that her people entered into with the state and federal government. Is this someone that you would be interested in admitting into your law school? And we did. She went to Penn, but she, you know, got into our law school too. That's what I'm talking about, is diversity. I'm talking about the ability to bring experiences. And if students on their personal statements indicate how their gender or race or ethnicity impacted the challenges that they faced in life, that is constitutionally permissible by my reading of SFFA. Now, I'm going to pivot for just 2 minutes because the name of this panel is Diversity in Modern Litigation. So I wanted to talk for just 2 minutes about what I call corporate reparations. Do corporations have a role in addressing historical racial harm? I would like to discuss corporate reparations because I'm currently writing a book of the same title. Hopefully next year when I come back, I'll be able to hold it up and share a link where you could buy it. But I wanted to start with this. This is a direct quote from the Fortune 1 company in the world, Walmart Inc., and its CEO, Doug McMillon. This is what Doug McMillon said after George Floyd was murdered. Doug McMillon said, CEO, Walmart, "What I've come to realize is that it wasn't just the physical weight of the officer that killed George Floyd. The forces at work were much greater. Behind the weight of the man was the weight of society, the weight of institutions and structures in which systemic inequality and injustice are ingrained. The weight that killed George Floyd also was the weight of history. 400 years of discrimination against blacks in this country. Together, these forces conspired to crush him. That weight needs to be lifted. It will take broad cooperation of leaders from every sector of society working together to create a force sufficient enough to bring about the necessary changes." So that's what we're doing. Walmart committed $100 million to racial justice causes. And Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan Chase, not to be outdone, committed $30 billion to social justice causes. So here's how I would like to end with some questions. Question number one, is it legal for these funds, $100 million from Walmart, $30 billion from J.P. Morgan Chase, to be expended in this way for social justice efforts? I think the unequivocal answer is yes. So long as the board approves and it falls within the modest parameters of corporate charitable giving rules, corporate leadership is free to make those commitments. Question two, is it permissible for Walmart to require that the law firms who represent them be diverse as to race, gender, LGBTQ status, worldview, religion? Is that permissible? I think the answer there is yes, that if corporations, Fortune 1 corporations, want to set up criteria for how law firms qualify to do their work, I think that's permissible. The question is, should they? And then finally, I'd like to ask this question. Do corporations owe a moral obligation to pay reparations to communities and populations who have been historically exploited and have helped those corporations gain massive profits upon which they were built? And that's the question that I attempt to answer in corporate reparations. I look forward to the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean. Now we'll hear from Toby.
Sorry.
Just speak
like
into
my
it.
My mom with buttons now.
Just talk.
Hi, everyone. It's nice to be here with you. And I appreciate this opportunity to have this conversation and that Federalist Society always facilitates great conversations and intriguing ideas. I don't have a long opening statement. I think it's fun to engage with the panel and the audience. I will say, you know, I am coming here and I think about this topic a lot in my role as an in-house counsel within a corporation. I don't bring my personal views to any of the legal work that I do in a corporation. I think that could be malpractice, right? If you're just, you know, whatever you want and not thinking about what the business is. What is your objective as a business? My job is to help them reach that objective as a business and do it consistent with the law. And I think that the Harvard case put a new legal kind of superstructure around that. I think it's been really interesting to watch lawyers in law firms and in corporate America approach policies around DEI a little differently than we approach almost any other policy. And I think we need to be consistent. When you're signing off on policies, are you asking, what does this term mean? How are you defining this term? We ask it in almost every context, and this should be no different. You know, I wanted to ask some lawyers sometimes, when you're signing off on equity, does that mean I get the same bonus that my boss does now? Is that what equity means? We're not defining it. We're moving forward. And I think the problem with that is nobody knows what the expectations are. Nobody knows what's fair, what's the rule, and will the rules stay consistent tomorrow? That's the gift the rule of law gives us, is this predictability, knowing what the truth is, what are we going to do? And with not, you find groups pitted against each other. You find it like an old Supreme Court case, a multi-factor test that can be changed and shifted depending on what the popular answer is that day. And I think oftentimes that doesn't really lead to a good outcome for anyone, even when it's well-intended and well-meant. You know, Thomas Sowell recently wrote something in the Hoover Institute looking at outcomes. The question's not, do we want to address opportunity? Do we want opportunity? Do we want to acknowledge the wrongs that are done? I don't think there's anyone in this room who doesn't want to do that. The question is, how do you go about doing it? And how do you do it to get the results you want? And I think you also have to look at affirmative action and say, has it given you the results you want? And so I would encourage people to look at Thomas Sowell's work, where he looks and says, it's not legacy admissions that are producing great classes, great outcomes and success. It's not necessarily admitting people by the color of their skin or their gender, but when you give people a chance and you give opportunity, no matter what color you are, if you haven't had that opportunity, right? Did your parents go to college? That's not, you know, that crosses everybody. What's your income level? When you look at that, you're tending to get better results. And so I think, you know, I think we have to ask critical questions and not just have good intentions when we're doing it. I would disagree slightly with the dean in saying that if you're not looking at the Harvard case and the impact it has as a lawyer, you're not doing your job. I mean, we've seen two law firms with Perkins Coie and Morgan Forster. They've had to change their programs because they've been sued. Companies are getting sued over their DEI policies. And again, I think it's because the lawyer sat down and didn't say, what is your objective? What are we trying to achieve? And how do we best do that? I think there's perfectly fine, as you said, Dean, for a business to say, my objective is when I walk in to meet a client, I want to make sure I have the best team in the room. And I want to make sure I have people from different walks of lives and perspectives to go and meet those clients. They're going to think outside the box. They're going to achieve things differently. But you can do that and also be consistent with the law and not put people at disadvantages and not pit people against each other. I think that's doable. I really believe that, and I think you have to try new things as you're going about doing it. So I'll be glad to engage and talk more, but
thanks so much, Toby. Okay, lastly, we have Professor Jackson.
Like Ms. Young, I'm going to try and keep this to a very short amount of time on the introduction as well. I've got a timer running, so I stay on track. But the first question I want to ask is, how many of you all watch racing, like car racing, horse racing, any kind of racing? How many of you watch it? Okay, there's a few hands coming up. I used to race motorcycles. That's what I did for part of my living, dragging a knee across the track. And one of the things you learn racing at 150 miles an hour is stay in your lane. Stay in your damn lane. I'm going to stay in my lane on this one. I don't do civil litigation. I don't run a corporation. So I'm going to tend to stay away from questions that are about that. But I know diversity, right? That's what I came in on, and that's what I worked at on George Mason's at George Mason's Law School. Mr. Severino started with a personal story, so I'm going to start with a very brief personal story. I got into George Mason, or I decided to even go to George Mason, because the director of diversity services said, hey, you should think about law school. I was a first-gen law student, not a first-gen college student, first-gen law student. I had no thoughts of going to law school. I didn't know what law school was. But for the encouragement of somebody who said, let me expand your horizons, much like Ms. Young was saying, I would never have gone there. And the first day that I walked in, I went in to get my books, right? And I'm standing behind a young woman. And as she talked to somebody else, it became clear her father had his name on a law firm. She was going to join a firm that already had her name on it. She had a history, she had a legacy that I couldn't even fathom. I didn't know what a tort was, much less what to do with it. And she and others were coming in with uncles and aunts and grandfathers and a legacy of students, a legacy of family that gave them a history that I couldn't even begin to imagine. I don't know, you know, and Mr. Severino said the students knew he was a token. Having worked in admissions, they don't know. They don't know. They're going to assume whatever they assume, and you can't control that. And that's kind of the sadness of this. People go, I was a token. Other students know, I know FERPA. Students don't know what you are. They might assume a variety of things. They might have to do with admissions. It might not, but they don't know what you're in there for. You might have been the number one on the candidate. They don't know. Unless you walk around touting it and espousing it, and that's a whole separate issue, they just don't know who you are. So Judge Boutimé started with the history of Plessy, and I appreciate Plessy, but if we're going to talk about Plessy, let's go before that, right? If we're going to talk about the case law, Dred Scott. If we're going to talk about case law, let's go back in case law. Dred Scott, this court, the United States Supreme Court said, black man has no right that the white man doesn't have to respect, right? If we're going to do constitutional law, let's do constitutional law. Let's not pick the fun cases. Let's go all the way back. One of the other things I did as a kid, and I'm curious if any of you do any sewing or crocheting. Do you do anything with like materials? Any of you? All right, I see some heads going up and down. My mom was big on that. She's like, you know what? I'm going to teach you how to crochet. We used to do these little coat hanger things. I don't know why, but you learned how to interweave fibers, right? And you learned how to build something out of nothing. And it was fascinating as a young kid, but I learned quickly when you made a mistake, you couldn't just go over it. You had to unwind all the fibers. You had to go back to the very beginning of the thing you created. And if we're going to talk about, and going back to Mr. Severino's discussion about constitutional history, then we have to go back to the origins of the Constitution, right? So Article 1, Section 2. Numbers which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 all other persons. If we're going to go back to constitutional history and we're going to start to unwind all this, then we have to go back to day one. And if we're going to unwind the fibers, we have to start with the first fiber, the first fibers. As we start talking about this idea about what diversity is going to look like and whether it should exist. My last few minutes, I'm going to talk about kind of the next phase of my life. I did the law thing first. I was a prosecutor right here in D.C., assistant United States attorney. I was an assistant county attorney out in Virginia before I decided it was the other way around. I did the assistant U.S. attorney thing last. I decided to go back into academia to work for George Mason as an assistant dean and director of diversity services. And during my time there, I realized I did not have a deep enough knowledge about how this whole academic thing worked. I knew I needed to dive deeper to get a better understanding. So that's when I went to the University of Colorado. And unlike all these private folks, I'm just a public school kid. Like, I'm straight up public school. South Lakes High School out here in the rest of Virginia, College of William Mary in Virginia, Southern Virginia, George Mason University for law school, University of Colorado. I'm a public school kid, none of this fancy degree stuff. But I decided to go back and think deeply about what education...
Don't be throwing the fancy stuff on me. I'm a public school girl.
That's what I want to hear. That's why I started off after you, because I felt that public school connection. Yeah. One of the things that we thought deeply about during my time during the PhD research was this idea of disproportionality. And I got to write a wonderful article with two amazing authors, Subni Anima and Deborah Morrison. Both are working... Subni's at Stanford, Deb's at University of Washington doing great research, but we wrote an article together called Disproportionality Fills in the Gaps. And much like Ms. Young, I think our article goes to the question she raises. Disproportionality fills in the gaps because I believe in data. It doesn't answer anything, but it starts to raise the questions. And when we see disproportionate numbers, for whatever reason, Hispanic, Latinos, LGBTQ, whatever, when we see disproportionate numbers, it should start our discussion about something. If you do see disproportionate numbers and say, I'm not gonna worry about it, which I tend to sense, I heard some voices shout out, you're gonna ignore disproportionate numbers, that's the canary in the coal mine. The second you ignore data like that, you're asking for resolutions and issues that you don't even know are coming down the road. So one of the things that was the beautiful part about that is we used it for education. And look at this idea of the school-to-prison pipeline and what was going on with people and ended up where. The dialogue, as Ms. Young suggested, is the beautiful part, because as soon as you can identify that there is disproportionality, we can dive deeper into the conversation. Maybe the disproportionality is logical. Maybe it makes sense. But until we raise the dialogue and dive into it, we're going off of assumptions. And that's never a good place to go. And with that, I'll stop.
Great. Thanks so much, Professor. So now we'll move on to the interactive part of this panel. First off, I want to give the panelists a chance to respond to anything they've heard. Roger, would you like to
say? So Professor Jackson, I also went to public school, and I do agree with you that disproportionality does grab people's attention. And the story of Harvard in particular, they became quite worried about certain disproportions, so they started doing interviews of students. The disproportion was, in their minds, there were too many Jews getting into Harvard. So they started to add a holistic, in their mind, assessment of students. They weren't gonna focus just on the scores and grades, because there were too many Jews that were being accepted, because they were looking at the disproportionality. That same thinking came out in the Harvard case just in the last couple terms. There were too many Asians, and you see the statistics, indisputable, that it was a hard ceiling. They would not let them go beyond a certain percentage, knowing full well that if they got rid of the box and if they stopped doing some of this, quote, holistic review, Asians would be disproportionate. I don't see that by itself as a terrible thing if we have more Asians at Harvard. If the system is fair. You mentioned the benefits of legacy admissions or connections in law firms. I agree. I don't like legacy admissions, right? That issue is not in the Constitution, but I think it's a bad thing and should be done away with because it's not fair, right? So I think we hopefully have some agreement there. But the general point is, yes, when you do see disparities, first, what is the cause of it? There are some good reasons, some bad reasons. And then the real issue is, what is the remedy? And that's what we're discussing here. And we have multiple ideas, whether or not if you have a truly colorblind society, which has become a dirty word in many circles now, you know, people are disowning Dr. Martin Luther King and his vision. I think it's a beautiful vision. And of course, we must acknowledge the history we came from. And I do think that the history includes colorblindness as a principle that was never really put into place well, but we got to get to it. And using race, as Scalia said, as a debtor race and a creditor race is not the way, and it will inhibit that ultimate equality.
Thanks, Roger. Dean, would you like to respond to anything?
I think that grounding in history, as I tried to do and as Dr. Jackson did much better than me, is really important. I also think that to Roger's point, I think Harvard was arrogant in their approach to complying with Bakke and complying with constitutional law. And I do think that they were, by trying to racially proportion their class, ran afoul of the Constitution. My point still remains that I think it's possible to have diverse classes of students and comply with the Constitution of the United States. Thanks.
Thanks, Dean. Toby? Nope, you're good. Professor, would you like any?
The only thing I'll add, and kind of in response to Mr. Severino, one of the things that I got to do during my time with George Mason was be a part of the admissions process. And as I did more research and analysis into this idea of, and I'm using the terms that often use, scores and grades, right? That's often this big hurdle to getting into college, much less law school. One of the things that we started seeing as we did a lot of research in the education school was these classes that are considered oh, you've got good scores, you got good grades, you got good placement material, are often largely dependent upon schools that have the resources to do that. So for students who are coming from marginalized communities, often schools that don't have it, they can't even get the class that then puts them into their ranking that somehow makes them competitive with other locations. So absent some type of diversity efforts, and I agree, those have to be continually reviewed, assessed, over and over again, we're segregating, we're eliminating students who have the potential, and that's really what we should be looking for in admissions. Do they have the potential to succeed? And the holistic approach is the only way you're going to get there. We're going to leave out students that just never had the resources to show what those that are making theoretically objective decisions on having those students come to their class. And the last thing I will say is, I always get concerned when I hear Martin Luther King referred to with regards to the colorblindness and the one line of the speech, because the next line of the speech was, this nation owes a debt that has yet to be paid. And nobody wants to go to that next line because that gets people uncomfortable. And uncomfortable is exactly where we have to be. If we're going to talk about the speech, let's talk about the whole speech. What about that debt? Has it been paid? How much is still owed on it? Because if we're going to bring his name, and God knows, amazing figure in the history of the country, then we got to talk about the whole speech.
Thanks so much. Roger, I wanted to ask you, what is your thoughts on the conclusion of the Harvard case? You know, I think most people agree that it does eliminate using a checkbox, simply a checkbox, when evaluating students. But there is the criticism that it does let you consider race through different means, such as personal statements of things. Do you agree with that interpretation, and you think that's okay?
So Dean Cummings did mention that life experiences matter. And I do agree, life experiences do matter. If you start behind and you overcome obstacles, that is important information. Now, query, how important is it in university settings and academics? How important is it in determining a legal team, right? But in many circumstances, it is relevant. The problem, and this was brought up by the chief, was that it cannot be used as a proxy. You can't simply, as a pretext. You can't use that as a pretext and say, you are a member of a minority race, therefore, if you mention that you've had something to do with race in your life, wink, wink, nod, nod, therefore you get in. Because many of the universities have been putting that front and center. Please tell us every type of racial instance of discrimination, of hardship, we all know what they're doing, right? It's rather transparent. And the chief warned about that, that it's gotta be real. And what tended to happen? So, as Professor Jackson said, yes, it matters the background. If you had parents that went to college, I mean, my parents did not go to college, Colombian immigrants, didn't speak the language, right? So yes, there were some opportunities I didn't have. The minority kids at the highest levels that get into the Harvards didn't have my background. They generally had a middle class upbringing, right? To get into the range so that they could be put in using racial preferences, right? So it doesn't mean that the problems you're talking about aren't still being manifested, right? It ain't that many poor kids at Harvard, period.
Fair enough. Dean, I wanted to ask you, in the post-Harvard world, you've eliminated the checkbox, and now you are doing more a deeper dive into the students' statements and other factors. I was wondering, as a normative value, do you think this new system is better? It seems like you're having a richer understanding of each student rather than simply looking at the race.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Judge. I want to be clear about two things. One is I agree with everything that Mr. Severino just said. Don't disagree with anything. And I want to be clear here. The Liberian war-torn refugee student, my argument would state that if he were a white student, he should be admitted based on that diverse experience. And if the woman that was an Alaskan native was white,
she should be admitted based on that experience. It's not checking the box. It's literally diverse experience as you progress through life. I think, Judge, that one of the things that's important to point out is that a lot of law schools in the United States have the staff, a lot of universities do, to do this holistic review. I have a niece. She is on the Harvard female rugby team. In fact, I think this weekend they're playing in the Final Four for the national championship. And if she makes it, I think it's Dartmouth for the national title next weekend. And I'll be, wherever Dartmouth is, I don't know, wherever I'll be there for the game next weekend. She's Polynesian. And she's a Harvard student playing rugby. She's fabulous, speaks Spanish, Samoan. She deserves to be at Harvard. Harvard gets 60,000 applications for 2,000 seats. That's tough. Harvard's got the money to hire enough admissions people to do holistic reviews. I just don't think they did. So I do think that requiring people to look at individuals' life experience is better. I think it's important, and to Mr. Severino's point, just by nature of being black or brown or LGBTQ doesn't necessarily mean that you weren't privileged, and this is about opportunity, equal opportunity. And so in a lot of ways, I think if admissions teams will do hard work, they can have really robust, diverse classes without needing a box to be checked.
Could I ask just a quick factual question? So you said that you do have a diverse class, mm-hmm. but you're not using a check in the box.
Correct.
How do you know, because you gave percentages, and just a factual one, how do you know that?
Yes, students self-identify. So once they're admitted, they self-identify as to whether or not they want to be identified as a particular particular LGBTQ or diverse member of a population. It's self-identification if they choose.
And how do you know if it's, how do you determine whether it's you've reached a diverse student body? And if you don't have a diverse student body, presume you would change something?
How
do you know that you're looking at percentages?
Yeah.
How do you know we've hit it? We got a diverse student body.
Oh, that's a good question. I really, for me personally, I was just speaking with a reporter earlier today, and one of the things that I stated was, black lawyers are about 4 or 5%. Of all lawyers in legal practice and make up 14 or 15% of the population. I think we should really shoot to have 14 or 15% of the legal profession being black lawyers. I think we should reflect society. I think that's how I would gauge having arrived. If our class represents the percentage of individuals that have been historically oppressed or discriminated against, but for me, ultimately, it's the exchange of ideas. It's the worldview diversity that people bring into the classroom that make, having been a law professor for 25 years, it makes the classroom conversations richer when you have people with varying viewpoints from different backgrounds.
Great. Toby, I wanted to ask you, correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like one of the biggest changes that we've seen in the corporate world is corporations' embrace of diversity and identity-based preferences. Could you explain, do you agree, number one, that that's true? And then can you explain why that's happened? Is it because of a profit motive, or is it downstream of culture at large? What's your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. So I think what you were seeing is corporations responding to clients, to shareholders, and, to the societies where they're headquartering. And I think there was a lot of pressure coming in, I think, Congress. When CEOs would go meet with members of Congress, they would ask these questions. And so companies started responding, right? I mean, that's what they do. They respond to their shareholders. They respond to their clients. And you kind of saw this crescendo. I think the case came out, and people started looking a little closer. And so there's been a bit of a retrenchment, I would say, from corporations. And that's for a few things. I think Republican senators started asking CEOs questions that they had never asked before. I think you have, you know, shareholders now saying, oh, well, this could be against the law to potentially do this. How are you doing it? How are you defining it? And so I think a lot of companies are looking at it and saying, you know, where should we go right now? What should we be doing? You know, and I don't think that there's been a retrenchment from the goals of having more people participate, making sure clients are getting the best innovation out of the box thinking. It's about how are we doing that, right? And one of the interesting tension points, there's a lot of tension points kind of coming up that I think will be interesting to watch in the court in the coming years is, you know, you have one side where companies are saying, okay, what should our DEI policy be? Where are we going to get sued? You're seeing a lot more companies get sued, right? So there's a reaction to that too. At the end of the day, an in-house lawyer, I'm pretty much an actuary who's a little bit more functional at a cocktail party, right? Like, I'm always looking at these and saying, okay, where do we need to calibrate here or there? And so companies are looking at it now saying, okay, I might get sued for having this policy. If I want to be a government contractor, I must have an affirmative action policy to do that. You have Europe putting in laws and regulations talking a lot about, you know, what is your diversity at your company, and you comply with that. And so I think it's a really interesting time for companies, just in the state of the law, to say, wow, what are we supposed to do? And it's a really important time for lawyers to step up and to think about it and help the business achieve whatever it is their objective, but do it consistent with the law, do it consistent with people being able to be successful and achieve things, and not feeling like they're being, I think it's really important to not feel like you're being pitted against each other, right? I had a situation where a law firm told me, this was before the Harvard case, that they were replacing a woman on a team because of diversity issues. And I said, okay, well, who is this new lawyer? What are they good at? Well, they've never worked on that issue before. And, you know, so you have to be really careful about, as you try to address past harms, not creating new harms, new situations, that we're going to then be going back. And I think it needs to be a thoughtful conversation. And like today, I think this is wonderful to show a conversation. I think a lot of people are really afraid these days to have a conversation and express their views. And, you know, what I tell people at corporations, when you're creating policies, when you're looking at how you define words, you need to assume your company is like a Gallup poll. And it's split down the middle, 50-50, on how they believe, what they think needs to happen, you know. Are you allowed to say you go to church at work anymore? It's, you know, people need
to... Are you allowed to say you voted for Trump and work in a law firm? You want intellectual diversity? That's a very serious question. Like, I know lawyers post-Trump who are told by law firms, oh, you worked for Trump, sorry. Like, just straight up banned.
We're about to open it up to the floor for questions, but I'll ask one last question for Professor Jackson. I think it's fair to say that, you know, you criticize the Harlan quote about the Constitution being colorblind, colorblind, and it's fair to say that the country has not lived up to it. I just wonder, should it be our goal that the Constitution is colorblind and that we should be striving towards that, or is that should not be the proper end?
I don't know whether we're at the place where we can talk about it, what it should be, because we still haven't really reckoned up with what it is, mm-hmm. what it was. And until you get through the first phase, kind of like the weaving of the fibers, yeah. you can't get to the next phase. Fair. And we can go through the work that was done in South Africa. We can go through the work that was done in Germany. We can go through the work that was done in Rwanda. I've had the fortune to visit all those places and seen the history and the work that they did. We don't do that work here. That's something we have never done. We've shied away from. We pushed it down. We close our eyes while other countries have done it. So I can't get to what it should be because we've never done the work at the foundation.
Fair enough. Thank you. So now we'll open it up to the audience for questions. So please state your name and any affiliation you have. And please make sure your question is actually a question. In the interest of time, I might push things along. So go ahead.
Sure. Andrea Lucas. I'm a commissioner on the EOC, a Republican commissioner. I wanted to follow up on the point that Mr. Severino made and direct this to the two law school and university members of the panel. What percentage of your law schools or your schools are conservative? Do you know? If you're looking for diversity of experience, you know, Wideners in Pennsylvania, 50%+ of the population voted for Donald Trump. Are you affirmatively screening for ideological diversity, and are you reaching out to, for example, conservative individuals who might be first-generation lawyers, like myself, who might not have that experience in their background?
Yeah, great question. Thank you. Oh. Our Federalist Society is super active at Widener Law Commonwealth, and they invite me to speak all the time at their events. I wouldn't be surprised if we were probably 50-50 at the law school. We don't do any political screening on the application, but just judging from the fervor and the election, and I've never lived in a swing state before. I was at the University of Arkansas previously, so these last 5 months have been pretty astonishing for me. And I know exactly where Kamala Harris and Donald Trump spent their billions of war chest money. It was in Pennsylvania. So I do think it's important to have political ideological diversity, and I think we have it at the law school. I think our students do a good job getting along well, and we do try to. One of the big things I try to do is have hard conversations like this at the law school, and so... I could see trying to avoid having the conversations. I just think it's hard. I think it's important to get into the grist of these hard conversations, and we do.
I'll answer that question with 99.9%. I went to George Mason University Law School while Henry Manning was dean. I teach at the University of Wyoming College of Law. 99.9% to answer your question, which is why I can come into an audience like this and be like, this is normal for me, right? This is my everyday. And I got to speak at Dean Cummings Law School a week or so ago, and one of the things that he said that I'm going to reiterate and answers your question is, we have some of the best, I know there's others, but we have some of the best jobs in the world. This is an amazing job, and it's because I get to play devil's advocate with students. So if I get a progressive response, I can be devil's advocate. And I tell them day one, I'm going to argue with you about everything. Doesn't mean I believe anything, because that's not my job. My job is not to make you think anything. My job is to make sure that you think. And so I will argue the conservative point if it's a progressive student making a point. I will argue the progressive point if it's a conservative making a point. But for my law schools, 99.9%, not just conservative, very conservative.
Sir?
David Applegate, Chicago Lawyers Chapter. I don't mean to appear to pick on Dean Cummings, but I have two questions for you. First, in all seriousness, are you any relation to the famous poet E.E. Cummings, or do you just share his disdain for capital first
initials? Thank you for asking that. I'm happy to answer it in a second.
The second question is, why should it trouble us any more that if blacks are 14% of the population, only 4% of the lawyer population is black, why should that concern us any more than that the proportion of blacks in the National Basketball Association or the National Football League is any greater? Is it because sports are less important? Is it because only black lawyers should be representing black clients? Seriously, what's the thinking behind that?
Thank you. As a high school student in the Los Angeles Unified School District, public schools, I took an AP Lit class where we read the poet E.E. Cummings and the feminist writer Bell Hooks, and neither of them capitalized their names, and E.E. Cummings doesn't care to capitalize anything or use punctuation, and as a high school kid, I was so inspired by the non-convention of it that I marched down to the Los Angeles County Courthouse and legally changed my name to all lowercase. So it's an homage to E.E. Cummings, not related, and homage to Bell Hooks as well. So for me, was it David?
Yeah.
David. For me, David, what troubles me is that there's a demonstrated grade, demonstrated LSAT gap, there's a demonstrated SAT gap. Often black and brown students or non-traditional or first-gen students perform more poorly on standardized tests. I do not subscribe to the notion that that's because they're less smart or less talented.
I think there's a problem. Right? When we're talking about meritocracy, is it only tests and grades? Right? Which is why I'm much more comfortable with what Dr. Jackson talked about when he said it's got to be holistic, because if merit is only tests and grades, then we're not accounting for the resource gaps, we're not accounting for what the testing gap indicates. There's lots of research that says stereotype threat is real and that other things are in place. And I'm not one to suggest that the LSAT and the SAT may not be culturally biased. I have a pathway program at my law school where we invite first-gen students and students from communities of color to enter and learn how to take the LSAT, learn how to get into law school, learn the process to try to defeat this resource gap. And every single class will read through an LSAT section, and some of my students, white, brown, black, will say, what do those words mean in your LSAT section? And that's either a failure of public schools or a failure of schools or just not being in those conversations where those types of words are used. So I'm not beyond saying that there's testing and grade gaps, and we need to figure out why there are if we're going to use grades and LSAT as merit. And then finally, believe it or not, David, I am a sports law professor. I've taught sports law historically over the years. I think the sports playing field is one of the few leveled playing fields in the United States where merit matters. If you've got game, you can play. And we weren't always, right? Because we had to have Jackie Robinson, we had to have, you know, people break barriers or what have you. But you know, where it's true merit, where it's truly like, what is it, ball don't lie? That's where you get, I think, a place where there's no obstacles. I think the LSAT and the SAT are obstacles, and we got to figure out better ways, I think, to equalize the playing field.
Thank you for that, too.
If I could. The Ivies that dropped SATs brought them right back. And do you know why? Because they started to admit minority students and setting them up for failure. It was going to be a national embarrassment, the level of people they would end up failing because they all of a sudden got rid of an objective measure that has use, because we had these standardized tests because they are indicative of something that is useful in higher education. If it didn't, they wouldn't have had it. Okay. Once you got rid of that and you go purely holistic, you lose that additional data point, right? There could be a lot of that. You lose a very important data point. Right? It helped me tremendously that I was able to do well on standardized tests, because no Ivy Leaguers were coming out of Rosemead High School in the LA Unified School District. Right? That gave me the opportunity to say, hey, take a look at me. Right? If you get rid of that, it ends up hurting the people you're trying to help. And it doesn't get to the underlying problem of why is it that some kids don't have the opportunity and some do. And that's a much bigger question of education, lack of school choice, things like the monopoly of the government on schooling, all sorts of reasons. And we're looking at these solutions so far down the line, at the last gasp of who gets to be on a case in a law firm. That is so far down the road to address a problem that has much, much bigger antecedents early on.
So this is part of my research. And I'm going to jump in now, because to say that they failed because of the SAT is a data point. I will give it that. It is a data point. But using your sports metaphor, I was blessed to play football all the way through college. I tested out for a few pro teams. I would have got annihilated. I would have got killed. If I put you in the middle of a pro team right now, you would die, because you have no training, you have no background, you have no ability to play at that level. You just don't have the background on it. If I put you on a racetrack, going back to the racing thing, you'd never raced a motorcycle, you would die because you have no training. You can't put students into an environment that's brand new to them. They have no grandfather that did it before. They don't have ancestry that did it before. And then say, survive. Just survive. The reason that they put the SAT back is because it was cheaper. Instead of putting the resources, and luckily I work with a lot of folks who work with student resources, instead of putting the resources into making sure that these students succeed, It's easier to say, oh, look, they just failed. When there's a plethora of data out there that says, if you provide the resources from day one, they will succeed. And that's a whole second challenge, how we define succeed, right? I've got a whole book out that has a whole bunch of chapters on how we've normalized what we define as success. And for a significant portion of these students, just being there was a success. Graduating was a success. And they didn't go to a big firm. They went back to their community and did other things. That was a success. And it was a success because their community wouldn't even have had it otherwise if they hadn't gone back to that place.
Thank you. Go ahead.
My question is, students...
Your name and affiliation?
My name is Shauna Bright. I work at the Federalist Society. My question is, do students, applicants, understand this new personal statement regime? I ask this because my brother's girlfriend came from an Asian family. She had to homeschool because she did bookkeeping for the family business. And when she went to do her personal statement, I said, you gotta play this up. You gotta play up this very sad Pain Olympic story. She would not do it. She refused. First of all, she didn't agree with my characterization of her background. From a rural community where I come from in Oregon, she's normal to her, right, where she comes from. And second, she had no interest in throwing her family under the bus in her mind to highlight the adversity that she had gone through. But I'll compare you to my brother, who was adopted black and has a very talented lawyer for a sister. His personal statement would be beautiful, gorgeous, perfect. Absolutely get into your program. No question in my mind, because I would write it for him. Right? I really worry about this gap between the people you're seeking out from challenging backgrounds who do not understand what I know, having lived in DC this whole time, and the upper middle class kids who know full well. So, what do you do to convey this to them? Yeah. Are you conveying it to them?
Thank you. And that doesn't even mention, you know, the use of AI writing personal statements now, and saying, hey, you know, write a really great, I don't even know what the prompt would be. I'm a Hispanic person from, you know, Los Angeles. Write a really great diversity personal statement for me. And how do we navigate that? You know, that's a really, really good and interesting question. I'm really very interested in hearing the other panelists weigh in on it as well. I would say that I don't know if the system's being gamed already, based on what the blueprint was that Chief Justice Roberts provided. I feel like, I could be totally wrong, but when I read personal statements, I feel like I can detect reality from AI or from, you know, now I don't know if someone's very talented lawyer sister wrote the personal statement or not. And maybe that's a factor in their favor, that they have a very talented lawyer sister that can write a personal statement for them. But it's something that we should be concerned about. It's something that we should, are people being truthful about the diversity in their backgrounds? Are they talking about the challenges that they face in a way that's real? And at this point, I don't know that we have the tools to either detect like the... Yeah. Yeah. So again, right, I have a super talented admissions team. I think I have the best admissions dean in the United States, like hands down, 200 law schools, I've got the best. And he talks to students everywhere. I mean, he goes across the nation and he talks at law fairs, he goes to HBCUs, he goes to Hispanic serving institutions, he goes everywhere. And I think it really at this point is like this pathway program I'm describing. It's like, I think you have to create programming to provide information and resources to help people know. This Alaskan Eskimo woman that I talked about earlier, she gave me permission. I've sent her personal statement to hundreds of law students and saying, I know you're not Alaskan native and didn't ride whales when you were a child, but this is the kind of thing that will help us understand who you are and what you're about. So it's about spreading resources and information and trying to get to those folks that have had opportunities waylaid to provide entrance and opportunity for them as best we can.
Great. Let's go to the next question.
Yes, Lorenzo Raboni from Philadelphia, Lawyers Chapter. I was taught by my family that I might not make it in this lifetime, but that's okay because my children may and their children may. And this idea of the multi-generational struggle, I feel like, has been lost on our society today, where we want instant results for people in this generation now, no matter who they are or where they come from. So legacy admissions, I want to know from the panel, aren't they valuable to institutions and family units? The institutions not only benefit from the knowledge of the multi-generational family, but also the kids that come to the institutions that their families went to know the institutions and their standards. So I heard some people talk about getting rid of legacy admissions, but I wanted to get your guys' opinions on that.
Go ahead, Roger.
In a personal statement, if you say, you know, I bleed crimson red of whatever X school, or blue, whatever it is, because my parents were and I'm now a third generation, that's useful information. It shows that you have a dedication to that institution. How it's done is, here's a checkbox, are you a legacy? And you're put in a separate file, or you get bonus points. And there's an idea that maybe if we keep doing that, we'll get more donations from our alumni. That's far less savory than a personal statement. It's kind of the flip side of what we're saying with race. There are some relevant factors of life experiences that come to bear. Legacy as a checkbox, I'm very skeptical of. I do want to say a separate point on the structural questions of, and it bears on your generational one. So I'm son of immigrants, first generation, and we have to be very honest with where we are with race relations. I think things have gone backwards in the last 10 years, at least. And when I was a kid, there was a hope that things are getting progressively better. And I think on all sides, you know, there's going to be a black tie event tonight. And I joke with my wife, will I be mistaken for a waiter again? Because it still happens when I go to black tie events, right? So we have to be realistic of where we are in race relations. But there was a mention of reparations in your opening. Something like that, I think, will impede the healing of these wounds as opposed to helping us heal them. And what that reconciliation fully looks like, we're working it out, but it is gone backwards, I think, in recent history. I don't know if any other panelists wants to comment on that one.
Toby, you want to? Okay, let's go to the next question.
Hi, I'm Ray. I'm from the Los Angeles Lawyers chapter. I also grew up in Rosemead as well.
You did?
Yeah.
Amazing.
So I agree with Dean Cummings' premise that SFAA does not ban just the total consideration of race. I'm just going to ask a little bit more specifically for the Asian American experience because that was the focus of the SFAA case. As the Plessy dissent has been quote here a bit, there was language in that dissent and how the Chinese were so different that they could not be integrated into American society. For 50 years, Chinese were not allowed to immigrate to America, thereby limiting the ability to build generational knowledge and wealth. And even for your sports analogy, I mean, you still see, I think, discrimination to this day. 10 years ago, you saw an athlete like Jeremy Lin, who was a California State Basketball Player of the Year, not receive a single Division I scholarship offer is quite a stark example. In the SFAA case specifically, there was evidentiary record had evidence that when alums would interview Asian students, they would give them ratings through the roof. But when Harvard admission officers looked at those same ratings, they all got downgraded for stuff like courage. At some point, you would, and you know, that was upheld by a district court opinion said, not a problem. A court of appeal said, not a problem. At what point, and this is the question, sorry for the long backstory, at what point do we say no more race consideration, like this ain't working?
Any panelists you wanted to hear from in particular, or just anyone?
Just open up for sure. The entire panel.
there is an industry targeted towards Asians in helping them get into college and massaging their personal statements and resumes to take off things that admissions officers will mark them as being not well-rounded. Things like, you did violin, you did badminton, you did, it is rank stereotyping, and they are being advised to take that off of their resumes. I mean, that should really trouble people that there's a whole industry around that because it's deemed necessary to get in because of the holistic approach that's being used.
So one of the things I'll chime in for my line of research is one of the things we do with, and if I haven't made it quite clear, I love looking at data, right? I love critiquing data, I love looking at all. But with the Asian issue as you raised it, there's a problem with aggregating the data, right? Because when we looked across the data for Asians, sure, Chinese, Japanese, South Koreans were all falling on one side of the spectrum. Vietnamese, Hmong, and a variety of others were not. They were the exact opposite end, but they were all being categorized as Asians. And so you get this very disparate outcome that if you don't take the time to break down the data and see what you really have, which is why I'm so big on looking at disproportionality across a wide variety of spectrum, you don't know what you're getting. So I don't want to use this global term. I'm very hesitant to ever use the global term, Asians, for that reason.
Point. Go ahead, David.
Hi, David Latt. I have a newsletter called Original Jurisdiction. Some of the panelists mentioned government. For example, Toby mentioned the possibility that if you're a government contractor, maybe you need an affirmative action program. I also believe that the Department of Education still requires some kind of racial or ethnic data from you, even though you might have removed the checkbox, Dean Cummings. So I was curious from the panelists whether they have any thoughts about, do they feel sort of caught between a rock and a hard place in terms of, on the one hand, they're not supposed to consider race. On the other hand, there are certain things maybe where they have to consider race. And do you expect any changes from the Trump administration?
Hey, David, it's good to see you.
I think you're the one person who didn't need to introduce himself here.
Yes.
I think there was a Wall Street Journal editorial a few days ago, 4 or 5 days ago, that identified 80 different government programs that have some sort of a, you know, affirmative action, diversity preference plan. And so I would not be surprised at all if the Trump administration doesn't start looking at that and reviewing it and deciding to make changes. I don't think that will surprise anyone. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that. But I do think, I think people are trying to figure out what to do, and I think it's a really important time for lawyers to give good advice and be thoughtful and help thread these needles. And I really think lawyers have kind of sat down on the job and let emotions and personal, you know, things come between doing their job and how do we accomplish this goal for our company. And, you know, I think that one of the interesting things I just want to say that everyone on here wants opportunity for more people. I mean, I think we've all experienced that. We have these stories that, you know, we weren't legacies, we weren't this and that. The question has to be, but we're still not getting the results that everybody's seeking. So what are we going to do, and how are you going to go back and change that? And, you know, I think the Trump administration will probably ask some of those questions. And one of the things with these programs that is unfortunate is they're so complicated and so difficult to pursue that, again, it's that unintended consequences that the people that they're really aiming to help and target with it often don't get to benefit from them, you know? So there's a lot to think about on it.
So there was an announcement, November 6th, Department of Education for a grant. Quote, in determining the quality of project personnel, the secretary considers the extent to which the applicant demonstrates that it has personnel or a plan of hiring members from groups that have historically encountered barriers, including gender, race, ethnicity, color, national origin. That is the Biden administration. That strikes me as a very clear, rather blunt, if you are a member of this group, you're going to get a preference, and if you're seeking a government contract, show us your hiring plans and personnel. I would expect that to change rather quickly with the new administration.
Okay, go ahead.
Roger Severino mentioned that by the time we get
your name and affiliation.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm another David.
Oh, there we go.
David Tryon. I'm with the Buckeye Institute in Columbus, Ohio. So Roger Severino mentioned that by the time we get to the question of who's going to staff a particular case in a law firm for a client, that's way down the line where the problem began many years before, and both Dean Cummings and Professor Jackson mentioned, well, a lot of kids don't have the resources to even get to the starting line, so to speak. And so to remedy that, many states have 15 states have recognized the problem starts with early education, and they have instituted educational choice to allow children who are stuck in failing educational systems, K through 12, to have a choice to move out of those systems. Right now, schools are putting in approximately, states and local school boards are putting in about $15,000 to $20,000 per student. Now, very few parents can afford that type of subsidy to put that out of their own pockets for their children to send them to private school. My question then is as to the Professor Jackson and Dean Cummings, would you support universal educational choice funded by the federal government to all children so that they can have those government resources, the resources that you say they don't have, so that they can get to the point that 15, 20 years down the road, they will have the same opportunities, the same skills, and the same competence?
So we're all lawyers, so you know my answer is going to be maybe. Right? And the reason I say this is I sit on the Colorado Advisory Board to the United States Civil Commission. I don't know what the whole land title is. But we did a report on that. And while it sounds lovely, it ain't real. And here's why. Most of those wonderful schools you're talking about are over here. Most of the places, people that we're trying to help gain access are over here. So if you give them school choice, that's a wonderful thing to say. But most of these schools don't provide busing from way over here to over here. And these parents are working two and three jobs and they don't have cars and they can't get their kid to this school. So while you gave them choice, they have no access. They have no ability. So until I'm much more concerned about equalizing all of the access points at these schools, the abilities for these schools to provide these classes, the ability schools to teach these, then I am saying choice, because choice generally, historically, the data supports, is going to put the resources in the schools that already have the best housing amounts to provide the property taxes to support these schools, and it's going to ultimately end up isolating these students from even getting to them. And then you add on the top that they have limits for how many students they can give the access to, and they're going to prioritize the students that already live here. And so even if you give this student choice, one, even if they could get there, they're the 107th one on the waiting list to get in there to begin with.
Briefly, you want to go, Dean? We're running out of time, so if you want to briefly,
15 seconds.
Go ahead.
I sat on a board of a private school for at-risk black children in one of my former institutions, and one of the things that was really clear to me, I love the idea, it sounds wonderful, as Dr. Jackson says, but there were so many, for this private school that was receiving the federal funding, there were so many disadvantages. There was homelessness, there was food insecurity, there were so many issues that came that it was really difficult for the students to get to the school, to have the opportunities. I think we have to really talk about socioeconomic disparities and how we address those in our country, and we just haven't gotten serious about it.
Thank you. Very briefly, DC is one of the best funded school districts in the nation per pupil, and the African American students that are allowed to use the voucher program flock to it and appreciate it, because the best funded schools are still failing them.
Ma'am, it'll be the last question.
My name's Evelyn Kies, and I am from Texas. I'm a retired Texas state appellate judge, and I now teach philosophy of law at Rice University because of another aspect of my education. But I want to amplify on what he said. One thing I have not heard the entire day and anywhere, it goes just before they get the school choice. Sitting on that state appellate bench, I will tell you that the most, among the most important things that we can do for our kids, for sure, is take care of our foster care system, take care of our homeless situation, and reinstate mental health laws. If we do those things, we can get those kids up to where they can compete. But you can't start at the top and say, well, we'll let them into law school now because we need diversity in the legal class. You've got to say, we got to get these kids into kindergarten. And another place it's really good to get them back to is church. And I don't care which one it is at all. But they, you know, they get some moral training. They get discipline. And there's nothing like having your hands hit by a nun with a ruler than to get kids able to be educated. I just want to know anybody's opinion on that who cares to speak to it and say I'm wrong.
Great. Thanks so much.
You're not wrong.
You could each have 30 seconds because we're running out of time.
We got to work on expanding the pool for the poor, which is disproportionate minorities. We recommend the success sequence. Graduate high school. Get a job, get married, have a kid, in that order. If that is drilled into children, that will end poverty. You're practically guaranteed to not be poor if you follow those things, the success sequence. Graduate high school, get a job, get married, have a kid, in that order. Great. And that will solve so many problems.
Toby, any final words?
Judge Cotts, I would never disagree with you nor argue with you. You're always a force of nature. I will say an interesting tidbit. When I worked for J.C. Watts on Capitol Hill, all the members of the Congressional Black Caucus had attended Catholic school. It was not expensive. They went to Catholic school, and it changed the trajectory of their life, the phenomenal education they got. And so there are a lot of things we can do that we're not doing, that we're shutting down, that can be thought about.
Great. Dean, you have 30 seconds.
We're the richest country in the world.
That's right.
And we do not take care of our children.
Right.
And we have to figure out a better way. I don't know that I agree with the 4 points, but I will say that I tried, Judge Kise, to address this in my previous statement. We have to figure out our socioeconomic inequality, and we have the resources in the nation to do it, and we don't have the will, and we have to figure out a way, in my view, to get there.
Look at CPS and mental health laws, for sure, for sure, for sure. Then we call it the cradle to prison pipeline, because it is.
Professor, you have the last word.
Much like Ms. Young, I know better than to disagree with you. But from an experiential standpoint, my first job as an assistant county attorney was doing child abuse and neglect litigation. So I spent all kinds of time in that foster care system working with those kids, trying to understand those kids, trying to help those kids. You are exactly 100% right, and the earlier we can get to it, the earlier we will solve it. But again, as Dean Cummings said, that takes resources and that takes commitment.
Great. Before we end this excellent panel, I want to give two announcements. First, for those of you seeking CLE credit, please sign out of the CLE program from the back of the program. And then I wanted to let everyone know after this panel ends, please go upstairs and exit this room and this floor because they have to start prepare for the dinner tonight. So please go upstairs immediately after this panel ends. So I think this is a great debate. So thanks so much for everyone.
Thanks, Roger. Thanks, Roger.